Chers auditeurs, chères auditrices, bienvenue à Radio Créum et à la balado-diffusion du colloque en mémoire de Jerry Cohen qui a eu lieu à l'Université McGill le 27 novembre 2009. Dear listeners, welcome to Radio Créum and to the podcast of the conference in memoriam of Jerry Cohen that took place at McGill University on November 27, 2009.
We thought we'd arrange it roughly chronologically. Jerry first came to the attention of the philosophical community as a reconstructor of Marxist thought. The first book of Jerry's that I read and was fascinated by was Karl Marx's Theory of History, A Defense. So Will Roberts, who teaches here at McGill, will first speak to that. So without further ado, I'll turn the floor over to Will for our first presentation.
I'm a little humbled to be here and a little humbled to be going first, in part because I wouldn't have known Jerry Cohen, the man, if I ran into him on the street. I only knew G.A. Cohen, the author of important and influential books in analytical Marxism. Jerry Cohen, so I'm told, was playful, funny, kind, generous. The G.A. Cohen I knew was dead serious. He was capable of wit, but he was harsh in his judgments and quite intimidating. He was also incredibly sharp and really knew his way around Marx. I read his work, everything relevant to the study of Marx, that is, when I was in Amsterdam working on my dissertation on Marx's concepts of labor. I found some of it helpful for my project. I found much of it ever so slightly disagreeable, and all of it rather less enticing than the Althusser that I was reading at the same time. Nonetheless, even in my youth, I recognized that Karl Marx's theory of history was the most formidable exposition of that other kind of Marxism. The attempt that to make sense of Marx in the terms of Anglo-American academic philosophy and social science. I took Cohen much more seriously as a Marxologist than I did John Elster, for instance. Indeed, footnote references to Elster in my dissertation included a parenthetical "sick" after the title of his book, Making Sense of Marx. It was quite apparent to me that Cohen, on the other hand, was seeking to clarify what Marx wrote precisely because he was convinced that, in rough outlines at least, Marx was right. Right about history, right about society, right about capitalism, and the need to overcome it. It was not my kind of Marxism, but it seemed to me an intellectually honest, respectable, and challenging kind of Marxism nonetheless. I didn't think Cohen would, or rather I don't, I don't think Cohen would have had the same judgment of me. In the introduction to the 2000 edition of Marx's Theory of History, Cohen recollected that before others taught me to call what we were doing analytical Marxism, it was my own practice to call it non-bullshit Marxism. He admits that that term is aggressive, since when you call what you do non-bullshit Marxism, you imply that all other Marxism is bullshit. He seems, for a moment, to undercut this aggressiveness in the text by conceding that there does exist a Marxism which is neither analytical nor bullshit, but this concession has a sting in its tail, because he concludes by naming this non-analytical, non-bullshit Marxism pre-analytical Marxism, and declares that whenever pre-analytical Marxism encounters analytical Marxism, then it must either become analytical or become bullshit. Since my Marxism encountered Cohen in about 2003 and did not, in that encounter, become analytical, it seems that I've been, for the last 6 years or so, a bullshit Marxist. Since the alternate title for this talk, or hence the alternate title for this talk, which is What a Bullshit Marxist Can Learn from Cohen. So I mean, I'm driven by the fact that despite all of this, despite my sense that Cohen would think I was a bullshit Marxist, I find much to respect and value in Cohen's work on Marx. And therefore, I want to press his definition of analyticity. And his commitment to analysis. I want to see whether or not it makes some sense to proclaim myself and others of my ilk post-analytical Marxists. To that end, I want to do what Cohen claimed in 2000 that he and his fellow analytical Marxists never did, that is, put analysis in question. My first task will be to get clear on just what analysis is on Cohen's account. It has both a broad and a narrow sense, and I will proceed to challenge each sense, beginning with the narrow one, which is anti-holism. I will argue that in the narrow sense defined by Cohen, analytical Marxism is not actually analytical. That is, it's committed to a certain sort of holism, or at least it's not opposed to all forms of holism. Then I will move on to discuss the broader sense of analysis, which is opposed to dialectical reasoning, something Cohen did not actually think exists. In other words, Cohen takes analysis to be identical with reasoning as such. I think there are good reasons for resisting this view, and that Marxists in particular ought to be wary of it. In order to show why this is so, I will enter into the realm of Cohen's actual Marx interpretation. I think that Cohen makes a number of observations about Marx and about Marx's project that can actually be read as motivations for a post-analytical Marxism. So first, on Cohen's telling, the fateful operation that created analytical Marxism was the rejection of the claim that Marxism possesses valuable intellectual methods of its own. This rejection can be seen to take two forms, one of which is necessary and sufficient to constitute analytical Marxism, the other of which is not entirely necessary. It's an augmentation of the first, and therefore constitutes something like a hyper-analytical Marxism. One can be an analytical Marxist without being hyper-analytical. The necessary form of the rejection is the rejection of so-called dialectical thinking, and I'll get to that later. The more exacting sense in which much work in analytical Marxism rejects any special Marxist methodology is the sense in which analytical thinking is opposed to what might be called holistic thinking for Cohen. My contention in this section is that Cohen's work does not meet this more exacting sense of hyper-analyticity. However, contra Elster, this is not because of Cohen's reliance upon functional explanation, for I shall further argue that Elster's rejection of functional explanation is at least as holistic as Cohen's acceptance of such explanation. Indeed, I think anti-holism simply fails as a criterion of hyperanalyticity. To begin, Cohen defines the narrow sense in which analytical Marxism is analytical as its disposition to explain molar phenomena by reference to the micro constituents and micro mechanisms that respectively compose the entities and underlie the processes which occur at a grosser level of resolution. I want to call attention to the three metaphors that are sort of intermingling in this statement. Of course, there's the metaphor of parts and whole, molar, constituents, compose, that naturally attends a discussion of holism. But there's also alongside this a metaphor of comparative size, micro, grosser, and a metaphor of structural levels, underlie. I think the metaphor of structural levels goes along with most any effort at explanation, and that it meshes unproblematically with either of the other two metaphors. That which underlies has an explanatory primacy with regard to whatever it underlies. However, I think the inclusion of metaphor two, the metaphor of comparative size, suggests more than it illuminates. It introduces the notion that explanatory primacy belongs with the smallest constituent parts and/or mechanisms. I think that there is good reason to resist this suggestion, and that purging this metaphor from the canon of analytical Marxism reveals that whatever anti-holism there is in its program, it is only an anti-one particular sort of holism. Taken seriously, the metaphor of comparative size would suggest a program of thoroughgoing physical reductionism, but of an extremely old-fashioned Democritean sort. That is, it suggests that being, or the being, characteristics and activity of everything big and complex is to be explained by the being, characteristics, and activity of basic atomic constituents. To explain something on this model just is to show how it is an epiphenomenon of the atoms. Regardless of how widespread or defensible such a model might be in the sciences more generally, not very, I suspect. It seems out of place here for two reasons. First, it suggests that only a reduction of social science to physical science would satisfy the hyper-analytical Marxist. But I don't think anything aside from this metaphor of comparative size indicates that they actually held this view. Secondly, and this is the crux of the matter for me, it suggests an essential and direct proportion between smallness and simplicity. This suggestion illicitly supports Elster's contention that his methodological individualism is an advance over Cohen's functional explanation because, among other things, although the individual agent remains, to some extent, a black box, it's a smaller black box than the economic structure. This notion of a smaller black box expresses in a condensed form everything I find worthy of suspicion in the metaphor of comparative size. For it assumes that what is supposed to support, that a decrease in the size of the explananda is a decrease in the amount of explaining left to do. In the social scientific context, the claim that social structures and processes are ultimately to be explained in terms of the beliefs, desires, and actions of individual persons cannot rest on the observation that persons are smaller than societies. Alongside this misleading metaphor of comparative size, however, Cohen also offers up what I take to be the real reason for preferring explanations of social phenomena be couched in terms of individual agents. Comparing current social science to thermodynamics before statistical mechanics, that is, to a descriptive science that as yet lacks a mechanism for explaining the regularities it observes and predicts, he avers that, quote, to claim that capitalism must break down and give way to socialism is not yet to show how the behaviors of individuals lead to this result. And nothing else leads to this result since behaviors of individuals are always where the action is in the final analysis. I take Cohen's pun very seriously. It suggests that individual agents are the loci of social scientific explanation because they are agents, not because they are individuals. Society is not a thing composed of a lot of smaller things. It is a structured complex of material and social relations, a complex that is enacted by the agents it relates. Hyper-analytical Marxism is invested in methodological individualism, I contend, because it is committed to the explanatory priority of agency over relations, the notion that how we relate to one another is determined by what we do. I think there's quite a bit of, you know, somewhat circumstantial evidence that, in fact, Cohen maintained this primacy of agency over relations. I'll only point to his endorsement of Marx's claim that material relations are only the necessary forms in which human beings' material and individual activity is realized. Note that since relations are the necessary forms in which individual activity is realized, the explanatory primacy of agency over relations does not imply any commitment to the existence of an agency outside of or otherwise independent of such relations. Just as, according to Cohen, every base needs a superstructure, agency needs relations and gets the relations it needs because it needs them. Now, whatever one might say for or against this thesis that agency has explanatory primacy over relations, it is not, I think, a consequence or expression of anti-holism, that is, of any sort of thoroughgoing program of reductionism. It does coincide with the denial that society is an agent, a denial which implies that society is not a whole of a certain sort. But this goes hand in hand with identifying an irreducible whole in the individual human agent. Individual behavior is where the action is. Action is not to be found at either a grosser or a more microscopic level of resolution. On this reading of Cohen's work, it seems to me that bullshit Marxists actually have a claim to be at least as, if not more, hyper-analytical than hyper-analytical Marxists, since post-Althusserian continental Marxism has been just as opposed to any holism of the individual subject as it has been to any holism of class or society. In short, if hyper-analytical Marxists seek to explain every social process and structure by reference to the beliefs, desires, and actions of individual human agents, continental Marxists seek to explain the constitution of individual human agents together with their beliefs and desires out of the material relations in which they always already find themselves. Both seem to me to be valid and important avenues of research. It's just not clear to me that analyticity or anti-holism is the most appropriate criterion for differentiating them. So that's the narrow sense of analysis. The broader sense of analysis, or by way of turning to the broader sense of analysis, I want to advance the notion that, in fact, bullshit Marxism has been, for the last 50 years at least, busy thinking about certain problems that Cohen's rearticulation of Marx indicates but does not really explore. There are two problems that particularly interest me. The problem of theory and practice that's indicated by Cohen's concept of fettering, and the problem of ontology that's indicated by Cohen's concept of power. In both of these cases, Cohen's theoretical return to the historical materialism of the Second and Third Internationals is helpful primarily insofar as it clarifies why continental Marxism moved away from that paradigm in the first place. That is, I want to read Cohen as motivating theoretically the move to bullshit Marxism that was originally motivated practically by the rise of Stalinism. So, first, fettering. In Cohen's construal of historical materialism, the forces of production underlie and explain the relations of production, that is, the economic structure, which in turn underlie and explain legal and political institutions, or the superstructure. The forces of production are natural or material powers, the relations of production are social powers, and the legal and political institutions are juridical rights and duties. One of Cohen's most important contributions to Marx scholarship is his rigorous attention to the difference between natural and social powers on the one hand, and to the difference between social powers and juridical rights and duties on the other. According to Cohen's historical materialism, the underlying trajectory of human history is the expansion of the natural power of human beings. That is, despite all local and temporary setbacks, there is a tendency for the forces of production to grow. In Cohen's parlance, the forces develop. However, since the productive forces produce use values, of which there is no common measure, the development of the productive forces is measured by the amount of the day which remains after the laboring time necessary to maintain the producers has been subtracted. The core of historical materialism, then, is this historical tendency of surplus material power to grow. Historical materialism is scientific, according to Cohen, because it is explanatory, because it maintains that the historical development of the productive forces explains the form taken by the dominant relations of production, that is, by the economic structure of society. Economic structures that allow or encourage this development in natural powers win out over those economic structures that hamper this development. Hence, any post-capitalist economic structure must be better able to produce surplus material power than is capitalism. As Foucault said to Chomsky, the proletariat will overthrow the bourgeoisie because it can, not because it is just. I'll return to this. Hence, also, social revolutions can be premature on Cohen's reading, just in the case where the forces of production are not developed enough to support the relations of production introduced by the revolutionaries. In other words, social or economic power, that is, the dominant economic structure, is functional for natural power and takes the form that is compatible with the current level of the development of the latter. Except, that is, when it is not and does not. For it's also true that, as Cohen says, the production relations are capable of fettering, that is, restricting the use and development of the productive forces. During any period of time when fettering is occurring, dysfunctional relations persist, according to Cohen. Cohen generally ignores this dysfunctional state of affairs. Indeed, he announces that he will generally ignore it. But it seems to me that it poses a significant difficulty for his construal of historical materialism, at least in that theory's practical comportment. And that the theory is supposed to be practical in some sense is evident by his claim that scientific socialism is the study of the nature of and route to socialism using the most advanced resources of social science. It's a problem because during periods of fettering, the relations of production are not explained by their functionality for the forces of production on hand, since they are dysfunctional given those forces. Hence, during periods of fettering, and I must note that Cohen thought that at least the US was in such a period right now, and had been since 1978 at least, the perseverance of the economic structure, if it is to be explained at all, must be explained by something other than the material powers as those are defined by Cohen. The material powers at hand are incompatible with the economic structure at hand and call for a new economic structure, and yet the economic structure persists. this state of affairs, and again, Cohen thought it to obtain presently in parts of the world, seems to throw us back on the other explanation Marx offers for historical change, the class struggle. Cohen claims that this cannot be explanatory in the final instance because reference to the class struggle does not tell us, quote, why the strong were strong and the weak weak. That's certainly true. Nonetheless, once you admit that fettering occurs, you must also admit that while fettering is occurring, and hence during revolutionary periods, the status of the class struggle is irreducible to the level of development of the forces of production. And so there must be other forces. There must be other forces, other powers that enter into the equation. Nothing but contesting the current relations of production will tell whether those social powers will fail. In short, the very concept of fettering indicates that taking the epochal view of the determination of economic structure by forces of production is inappropriate for the political and social structure to transform that economic structure. Waiting for the forces of production to burst their fetters is like waiting for Godot. I don't think I'm saying anything that's contrary to Cohen's own declarations. Nonetheless, I do think that Cohen's historical materialism cries out for what it does not itself supply, and that his thumbing his nose at appeals to determination in the last instance and other such opaque ideas is no help. The functional explanation of social power by natural power breaks down right where those who are concerned not to interpret the world but to change the world begin their work of thinking and acting. I think this has far-reaching consequences, to which I will return after a closer consideration of Cohen's understanding of power itself. Power. So Cohen rather famously attempts to purge all legalistic language from the definition of the various relations of production, and hence from the definition of the economic structure, replacing it with a distinct language of effective powers. The point of so doing is to articulate a method of conceiving the economic structure which excludes from it the legal, moral, and political relations of man. This conception is in the service of a general explanatory thesis that, given property relations have the character they do because of the production relations property relations with that character support. That is, if productive relations explain property relations and other legal, moral, and political categories, then production relations cannot include or be defined in terms of property relations or other legal, moral, or political categories. Instead, production relations are defined in terms of power, of being able to do something, where able is non-normative. Cohen seems to be at pains, however, to avoid any sort of ontology or physics of these social powers. Hence, he claims that his definitions of production relations do not stipulate how the powers they unfold are obtained or sustained, and that your power is what you are able to do regardless of what makes you able to do it. And yet I cannot see why he would be so reticent, since it would seem that some account of the sources and concrete forms of social power would go a long way towards both clarifying the distinction between natural and social powers that undergirds the distinction between forces and relations of production, and pointing the way to some explanation for the persistence of dysfunctional relations of production. This is the path that's taken, I think, by continental Marxists when they turn to analyses of the culture industry, of hegemony, of the reproduction of labor power in ideological state apparatuses, of technologies of discipline and security, of the organization of labor in Taylorism, Fordism, and post-Fordism, and so forth. Many of these investigations also encompass returns to early modern philosophy, to Machiavelli, to Hobbes, to Spinoza especially, in order to flesh out an ontology of modern social power. The point was to explain the sorts of phenomena that Cohen merely points to. So to name a few, that in modern societies, rights screen powers, that might, that is power, frequently needs right in order to operate or even to be constituted, that hence social powers are sustained by the law, morality, and the state, that capitalist society propagates and reinforces ignorance of power, etc. It seems quite obvious to me that while the historical materialism defended by Cohen brings these phenomena into view, nothing in Cohen's definitions of natural or social powers helps us to explain them. Here, as in the case of fettering, Cohen, I think, exhibits a frustrating tendency to fall back on something like common sense at just the point where his explanatory project ceases to explain. It's just obvious that legal systems and codes of morality help stabilize relations that would otherwise rest solely on force. But to borrow a line of analysis that Cohen uses to discuss fetishism, laws and norms don't stabilize social powers autonomously. Stabilizing power does not inhere in laws and norms, but is delegated to them by other forces and powers. What is missing in Cohen, then, is any effort to naturalize law, morality, and the state in the way in which Marx tried to naturalize the commodity and capital. That is, what's missing is the dual attempt to, first of all, to trace the power of law, morality, and the state back to some natural power. And second, and this is at least as important, to trace the origin of the separation of these powers from their natural bases back to the operation of those bases themselves. If the state's power is really rooted in coercion, to just take a random example, why does coercion take the form of the state, rather than being directly and transparently expressed as coercion? Cohen quotes Marx's Grundrisse as follows: "The bourgeois economists have a vague notion that it is better to carry on production under the modern police than it was under, for example, the law of the club. They forget that the law of the club is also law, and that the right of the stronger continues to exist in other forms, even under their government of law." Close quote. What I'm protesting in Cohen is inattention to the problem of explaining the origin and operations of these other forms of the right of the stronger, and his corresponding blindness to what is actually going on in the continental Marxists that he ignores or dismisses. And so then this brings me to the question of how necessary Cohen's analysis is. It's been noted that both Althusser and Cohen's work, that is, the two landmarks of post-war Marxist philosophy, coincide with the greatest period of crisis in the Marxist labor movement and revolutionary program, excepting only the collapse of the Soviet system, if the latter can even be separated from this crisis of the 60s and 70s. And yet, as Graham Locke notes, Cohen's book, quote, "Cohen's book shows no sign of having been written in this context of crisis. Rather, it was written as, and has been received as, a more or less purely philosophical treatise in a quite traditional sense of this phrase, as a work to be read and assessed in abstraction from any consideration of its possible roots in or impact on the political and ideological situation." This appearance seems to me quite essential to Cohen's work, and it seems to me to be of a piece with what he refers to as the broad sense in which analytical Marxism is analytical. Cohen was committed to a set of values, socialist values, what he calls, about which we are bound to hear more today, I'm sure. And he was committed to analysis as the form of reason as such. Marxism, though, as a movement, as a tradition, as a set of problems and texts, as a set of critical theses about capitalism, this was secondary. But if analytical Marxism is necessarily committed to analysis, if, as Cohen says, quote, "it is always Marxism, not analysis, that is in question," then it seems to me that one cannot be committed to Marxism without being a bullshit Marxist. Cohen compares this to turning Marxism into a religion, but doesn't say what differentiates a commitment to a tradition or a movement from a commitment to a set of values, or why the former would be religious while the latter is not. And given his late appreciation of Christianity, perhaps there is no difference. So perhaps in the end it all comes back to the title of Cohen's book for me. Cohen set out to clarify and defend a theory of history, but nowhere does he clarify or defend his decision to read Marx primarily as a theorist of history. Cohen seems to suppose that the socialist movement finds its origin and justification in a theory of history rather than the other way around. In actual history, the theory of history Cohen defends seems to have served primarily as a motivating myth, a means by which workers could transcend the opportunistic and purely economic struggle for better wages, safer workplaces, etc., and become political subjects with a world to win. And Lars Lee's work on Lenin's relation to German social democracy, I think, is very illuminating on this point. In other words, the theory of history was a weapon, in the sense that Marx meant when he wrote as a young man, that theory also becomes a material force as soon as it has gripped the masses. This notion that the struggle is primary and that theory is something that emerges from and finds its ends in the struggle seems alien to Cohen's work. And that is why I don't lose a lot of sleep over the fact that I'm a bullshit Marxist. Nonetheless, precisely because Cohen recapitulates a certain history in the realm of theory, and therefore in some sense motivates my concerns, I would only second the assessment of Althusser's friend and student Dominique Lecour, who in reviewing Cohen's book wrote that it is, quote, one of those books on Marx, which are so rare, whose grandeur consists in their forcing the reader to rethink the whole structure of Marxism from the philosophical foundations up, even if he goes on to draw conclusions diametrically opposed to those which the author proposes.
Okay, well, thanks, Will, for getting us off to a great start. We'll now open the floor for questions, comments.
You want to say that it is a constitutive of analytic Marxism to say that agency has priority over relations at the ontological level? Because if you want to say that, I'm not sure that would apply, say, to Elster. Well, you know, for Elster, you know, making sense of Marx, sick. he makes a distinction between, you know, external and internal relations, and internal relations are crucial for his characterization of a methodological individualism as he sees it. So you don't have an account of individual agency there, which is not already drawing on relational facts in which the agents are placed. So I'm not sure that if Elster was an analytic Marxist and he didn't think that agency was prior to relations, then it is not true that analytic Marxism entails seeing agency as prior to relations.
I mean, Pablo, I would generally defer to you on the understanding of Elster. I think that. I mean, I think I would say two things. First of all, I'm mostly interested in, I think that Cohen is committed to this. And second, I want to differentiate that claim from the claim to be anti-holism. And I don't think that those two methodological claims are identical, and that not only do I not think they're identical, I don't think that the anti-holism follows from is perhaps even compatible with the priority of agency over relations. So if, in fact, Elster does not hold the priority of agency over relations, then perhaps he is more of a reductionist than Cohen is, and we could talk about the relationship between the two of them. So that's all.
Unfortunately, I missed the beginning of your talk, so I'm not sure. I guess what you're trying to argue is against a form of analytical Marxism. You're trying to say that the kind of methodological individualism is not sufficient to or cannot fulfill the task it sets itself in a way that it's maybe not sufficiently justified, and sometimes we seem to end up with a kind of Marxism that is very partial when we look to the whole tradition of what is Marxism. So I have two questions. My first question is, I don't understand how why methodological individualism couldn't be able to explain beliefs and desires in terms of social environment. I mean, it's surely more complicated to do that, but I think that someone like Elster is very open to a kind of theory of ideology which is based on individuals and cognitive biases and these kinds of things. And my second question is, I don't see how it's not being a Marxist when you focus on Marxism in its pretension to be a kind of explaining theory. So if Cohen is focusing on Karl Marx's theory of history, and I think we find that in others, other analytical Marxists, where they say that we are Marxist in the sense that Marx was a social scientist or philosophers, and we are committed to the same values, and we will focus on some claims and test them according to the contemporary result in social science, and this is how we respect Marx as a social science. Not we are not committed to specific claims. We're committed to values, to a method, and also to a kind of intuitions that we will test with new methodologies or results, and then we end up maybe with different theories, different explanations of but I don't see why this should be considered less Marxist than another theorist that would take Marxism as a whole, its history, the class struggle and the movement, and see the theory only as a kind of tool for a movement.
So I'll take the second one first. I guess my claim is that, or my question is, why be so convinced that Marx is primarily a theorist? In the sense that it's not at all clear to me that Marx first tried to explain the world, and then on the basis of an explanation of how things are, to effect some change in how things are. It seems to me that, and that there is a broad swath of Marxism, academic Marxism, theoretical Marxism, that nonetheless takes Marx to be primarily an activist and secondarily a theorist. And if you take the activism to be primary rather than the theory, then Cohen's project seems a slightly odd one, right? Or it doesn't seem to fit with that primacy of activism, and that's the only claim that I want to make, and that for me, locating myself as I do, I think there are lots of things to learn from Cohen, but I don't feel the need to take his project on as my own. If one reads Marx primarily as a theorist, then it seems like one is primarily identifying oneself also as a theorist who's primarily interested in getting things right about the world, primarily interested in explaining things. And I don't think it's obvious that that's Marx's primary concern. So that's the second question. The first question, I don't want to get too far into the woods of methodological individualism. I guess I think that there is a way in which methodological individualism presupposes methodologically a particular model of agency, a particular model of the subject that, again, is, and their acceptance of that model is as a heuristic model for explaining and understanding things, right? They think that that model works in an explanatory context. And if you are not, if you're not primarily interested in explaining phenomena the way that methodological individualists like Marx, like Elster are, then there's nothing they're going to say to you, I think, that is going to force you to get on board with their project. And that's all. I'm interested in the question of whether or not, I guess I'm interested in assertive self-defense, right? Why is it that I'm not doing the sort of thing that Cohen and Elster are doing? And I think that regardless of the value of what it is that they're doing, there's no prior commitment that I have that is that they're going to be able to rely upon to force me to get on board with their project. And that's about as far as I want to go.
Can I pursue? Oh, okay. There's a.
There are a couple of questions, so let's see how we're doing for time. When.
Okay.
That's all right. Jacob.
I want to ask the usual question about what kind of post in post-analytic Marxism. And the usual distinction is you can be post-chronologically or you can be post-synthetically, where it was a necessary stage for you to be where you are that someone else was where they were. And I heard intimations of both over the course of your talk. The intimation of post in the sense of synthetic was that there was something on the agency side that the analytic Marxists really restored into the intellectual tradition, and that building a Marxist tradition going forward, one needs to take fully into account not only what Althusserians taught us about structure, but also what the analytics taught us about agency and the problems of collective agency and so on. But I wonder whether I was hearing that in a mood of generosity on your part, because it's not as though questions of agency and the problem of structure and agency were alien to the Althusserians. It's not as though they were only ever structuralists. Do you think that there is something that Cohen in particular, set Elster aside, that Cohen in particular provides by way of a theory of agency that Marxism needs going forward that was distinctive and novel that you don't find the resources for in things that were happening before him?
Well, so I guess what I'm going to do is I'm going to return. I think this the answer to this question is sort of, I tried to encompass it in my little phrase about Cohen motivating theoretically what was motivated practically for many continental Marxists. That is, I think the things that the problems that Cohen points to and the struggles around the question of agency that he sort of delivers us over to if we think through his work, are the problems that the Marxist movement, I think, faced in the mid-20th century in Europe. And so I think you can arrive at the beginning point of something like Althusserianism via a reading of Cohen if you didn't live through all of those fights about Stalinism in the French Communist Party in the 50s and 60s. So I think there are, I take it that Cohen offers a different route to the same point.
Okay, maybe last comment for now from Peter.
I have a question about the persistence of dysfunctional productive relations. Now, if I understand you correctly, you say that the fact that dysfunctional productive relations exist implies that we have to appeal to forces other than the natural forces of history to explain change in the systems of production. And I wonder whether it's not at least a conceptual possibility that there are periods where the natural forces of history are not strong enough to trigger change, or differently put, the dysfunctionality is not strong enough to trigger change, but that we could still have a conceptualization where we rely on those forces alone to explain change. And so, I mean, why do you think that we need something else? I don't necessarily see that follows from the argument.
Well, I think at any point where you say the forces of relation, if you say the relations of production are explained functionally, explained by their functionality for the forces of production, and admit that there are periods of time when the relations of production are dysfunctional in whatever, to whatever extent, with regard to the forces of production, then it seems like you're saying there are inexplicable periods, or there are inexplicable moments in history, right? There are points in history where my explanatory thesis doesn't explain what's going on. And that's, and I think that that's true regardless.
Okay, one sentence.
Well, you need to distinguish between the emerging, the emergence of a phenomenon and its stability. We could still explain functionally the emergence of relations of production and say that since it attains a kind of stability, then there's a period where we could say there's feathering. It introduced a kind of dissonance in terms of its function, but
when's the stability? Where does this stability come from? Why would the relations of production be fluid and then be stable?
Because, well, it could be stable at first, you know, when it emerged, because functionally it serves. I mean, anyway, we have to end.
I have to move on.